By the way, Jonathan didn't come in through Echolink. Echolink, unfortunately, is down tonight, so I won't have my usual guy from Australia who listens to us this way. I believe that Jonathan got through IRLP, which is a different technology, which also uses the internet, but in a slightly different way.
Well, you know, that disproves my point, because you wouldn't be talking to those guys, you know, without IP, voice over IP. But I would say 85% of the fun of this hobby for me for 58 years was stringing up antennas and walking quickly back to the shack to see how, you know, how clear I can be heard and hear things. I would say that's been most of the hobby for me for all these years. Buying a new rig, yeah, that's cool, you know, for a week, two, three, four. But nothing like trying a new antenna configuration through the trees or wherever.
In my humble opinion, one of the big things that I love about this hobby is the incredible depth and breadth of the possibilities. There are so many different ways that you can find enjoyment. And so if people find enjoyment on voice over IP, whatever they want. I prefer to have at least one link that's RF-based. But again, I know a very nice man who's locked in an apartment without any kind of access to a decent antenna. He bought into some kind of internet service that gives him a full QRMs and QRN and all kinds of problems that kind of make it seem that he's having a phone conversation, but it's all voice over IP. And it brings him pleasure. So I don't want to take that away from him. I wouldn't do it myself, but if that's what floats one's boat, so be it. So I think there's more than enough room for all of us to have all of our definitions of what amateur radio is. I have a problem occasionally when people tell other people what amateur radio isn't, but that's just me.
Because there are 27 or so different kinds of ham radio, you really should try to use more than one of them. The saddest situation could be a guy who is on 20 meters, he just loves the DX, he's talking to his buddies hundreds and thousands of miles away, and then the bottom of the sunspot cycle comes, and he can no longer talk to those particular guys on 20 meters, and he goes into depression. A somewhat similar situation occurs with the guys that do analog moon bounce. They get super weak signals off that bounce off the moon on 2 meters or 432 or 1296. Because the signal is so weak, the majority of the information, let me drop. It's a valid QSO if they recognize the full set of calls. They get one additional piece of information like signal strength, and they send back 73s or Rogers in both directions, RRR, and that's a QSO and they get a card. But you're not really having a conversation. A guy doing pure moon bounce is going to get discouraged after a while. He's got to choose some other band where he can have real conversations with people and compare rigs and antennas and transmission lines. Man is a social animal. Just hello, goodbye, send me a card, particularly during contests, that doesn't do it for the majority of us. You really want to pick each other's brain, so to speak. I don't care if you're discussing politics or electrons, but whatever you're interested in. So do sample some of the other 26 kinds of ham radio from the one that you're using. Otherwise, you could, in some cases, end up discouraged in a period of time. And that discouragement is predictable ahead of time, if you know what I mean. If you're not really QSOing with people, not really having conversations, that's an opinion. AC2GS, K2RIW.
To our QSO.
Yes, Lou.
I've parked, and I was about to get out of the car, but I have something that I would like to toss out as a project. And, Rich talking about antennas, and Paul talking about the SpaceX. This is a satellite-related project. Can I toss it out, Dick?
You could say this is Roy's time, so Roy, what's your answer?
Feel free, Lou. My time is your time.
Okay, I haven't been on the net for quite a while, so I didn't even realize what time it was. I have in my garage a, I guess it's 20 feet of tower and two cross-polarized Yagis, one for 70 centimeters and one for 2 meters, and a couple of rotators. And we took that down from an installation from an estate of Silent Key in Queens, and I just couldn't see it going to waste. However, I don't have the time or skill to put the whole thing back together, and the intention is, if we can get it working properly, we'd like to try and get it over to the Cradle of Aviation Museum. So if anybody is interested in pitching in on this project, my call sign is N2RQ, and I can be reached at ARRL.net.
Okay, thank you very much, Lou. Getting back to the previous comment, so, I don't know, a lot of people seem to like contests. I kind of glaze over when I listen to them because they're not terribly informative for me. But, you know, we all have our best and worst stories. I mean, my worst story of a guy who didn't quite, in my opinion, get the hobby, got his license, bought a Baofeng, had some fun, bought a second Baofeng, had some fun, bought a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. He's, I think, 13th the last time I talked. I think he's in a bit of a rut personally, but, you know, whatever works for you, eh?
W2BZ, can I make a comment, Roy, or you're turning it back to
me? Rich, feel free.
You know, I've been realizing that, you know, I like CW. When I haven't been on HF, you know, in a number of years now, but whenever I go on, I do go on CW, and, you know, and because, you know, I'm not that fast and can't have real conversation with the big boys, you know, it's all about, you know, signal report and antenna and whatever. That's 90% of it. Sometimes you can get into a real CISO. And after a while, you know, I get bored with it. And it's the same thing, you know, on the low bands when propagation is good. It's mostly about your signal report, what antenna you're using, and rig and all that stuff. But, like you were saying, on 80 and 160, there are groups of guys and some women that, you know, get together all the time. And it's fun to listen to them. A lot of the southern ones, like North Carolina, South Carolina, those guys are real fun to listen to. And I guess, as you say, propagation is not interfering with those, but yeah, you know, just exchange like Dick keeps saying, just getting the card, you know, gets old after a while.
Yeah, there's some fine good old boys down south who some of them are a little flicky. They don't want to really talk to strangers. Others are very nice and open about it, and I've had all kinds of conversations. I tend to prefer the ones not about the weather or lunch or the best place for a pastrami sandwich, but again, that's just me. Although I still remember, I spoke with a guy in Arizona on 10 meters a few years ago. He apparently looked up a real estate website and started to discuss how many square feet my house had, and the room was pretty good. And I don't know, that was a little too much of a personal kind of conversation, if you will.
B2GXM, comment.
XM recognized. What would you like to say?
TGS McGroup, WB2GXM. Rich, well, when I started as a novice in the 70s, and I started with Morse code, with CW, sorry about that. And at the time that I started using CW was the time that chess was really big in this country. That was Bobby Fischer, Boris Spassky, and the rest. And I got into a habit of having a chess game via CW with another amateur in Maryland. And that was a very enjoyable time. So another way to enjoy the hobby, WB2GXM.
How fast were you going?
I believe we didn't hit anything more than 13 words per minute. But we still, we made a mistake of not repeating each other's moves back to each other. So many times he would say that I was checkmated and I was only halfway through the game. Of course, that was because of a wrong move. WB2GXM.
Wow, that sounds interesting. I haven't heard of that. You know, I got licensed in, what, 63, 62? And had a lot of fun on CW, even on 6 and 2 meters around Queens with my Polycom 62B. If Dick is listening, Roy, let me ask, or Dick, both of your permissions, can I ask an antenna question? This is W2BZ.
And WS2N, one last comment before this launch.
Yeah, right now it looks like they're getting very close to launch. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, sounds like you might have it on in the background. Yeah, they got 3 minutes and 40 seconds. And then roughly 8 minutes before the thing actually, you'll see this thing actually come back and land. It's only about 1,400 feet away from where it takes off from.
Paul, did you get a chance to make the announcement you wanted to make?
As the thing goes up?
Was that for me? I missed that. WS2N.
Did you get a chance to announce everything you want to? Like, it's going to take off in 3 minutes. Was that the main thing you wanted to tell us, Paul?
Yeah, sometimes these things don't make it, but this one's going to go, it looks like. If it doesn't go, it's an instantaneous window, so if it doesn't go exactly on, you know, within that second, then they would scrub until tomorrow or the next day. But right now it looks good. And it should be pretty exciting to see this thing come back after 8 minutes. That's going to be cool. Back to you, Dick.
Roy, I think Rich Baker Zulu wants to ask us an antenna question. It's up to you, Rich. Go ahead.
I'm personally fine with it. Rich, ask, and I'm sure that this will give you a great answer.
Okay, real quick. I'm talking on it now, but I have like 20 feet of PVC, you know, connected with couplers, and it's a half-inch PVC. So the antenna's actually bending over like, you know, I had a fish on the line. But tomorrow, it'll be vertical. I have two elements, two rods, 19.25 inches each, one going up, one going down. They're attached to the side of the PVC. And I was wondering, Dick, how critical is it that the transmission line comes off for at least a quarter wavelength or a wavelength 90 degrees from the PVC or the elements going up and down, which is going to be hard to do because I'm sliding this thing up a big tree. And it would be almost impossible if I had connector, you know, with that would I put the transmission line through.
Okay, yeah, you didn't give us a clear picture, Rich. Is it a ground plane antenna, a dipole antenna, or a Yagi antenna? It's on a piece of PVC that's leaning over like a fishing line, and you want to bring the transmission line off at right angles. I'm not sure what kind of an antenna you're talking about. Go ahead.
Oh, it's hanging out. I just replaced it with my other antenna. Roy and some other guys know about this. No, it's going straight up a tree, you know, and I'm going to attach a straight piece of PVC up a tree. At the top of the PVC, there is a 19-inch rod pointing up and one pointing down. They're clamped onto the PVC with, like, automobile-type hose clamps. You know, the main, you know, the center conductor and the braid. And so it's just going straight up, and the only way I could do it is have the coax come sort of straight down instead of out at a 90 degree angle for...
Okay, you have a 19 inch rod going up, a 19 inch rod going down. You didn't say it, but I presume you're feeding it in the center. The rocket's just placing off right now. I guess it's a dipole, even though you didn't tell us that. And now your transmission line is running almost parallel, probably not very far away from the downward going rod, and you want to know how bad that is. Is that the question, Rich? Go ahead.
The question, I mean, how much am I losing by having that, the transmission line come straight down parallel to the element going up and the element going down center fit?
It's not clear. You might not be losing anything. You didn't say you've got a balancing device. Without the balancing device in there, the shield of the transmission line probably went to the lower rod. So whether you brought the transmission line exactly off at right angles or run it parallel doesn't matter very much. In either case, if there isn't a balancing device there, your transmission line is hot with some of the options. That's not just, it's not bad. It just means that the antenna pattern is different than you think. Are you losing anything? Maybe a little, but it could work quite well. And maybe it is. Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
2BZ. Yes, the rod, the element, whatever you want to call it, that's pointing down, that's where the blade is attached. And the center conductor is, you know, the one going up. And it's going to go about 20 feet. And I thought a vertical, 2 meter vertical, it's almost mandatory that the transmission line right at the feed point come off 90 degrees for at least a quarter wavelength. And I'm glad to hear you say not necessarily.
If you ran an experiment with the way the transmission line is now and then brought it off at a 90 degree angle, with a whole lot of mechanical contrivances, you may find that there's no difference because you have a hot transmission line regardless because there is no balancing device. Mother Nature always wants the dipole-like structure to be balanced. She wants half the voltage on each half of the dipole. Well, one half of your dipole has got a braid connected to it of the coax. Therefore, some RF energy is crawling down the outside of the coax no matter how you address it. And so, you'll have a slight change in the pattern, but not much of a change in the efficiency as you bring it off at right angles. Without the balancing device, how you dress the coax almost doesn't matter. But in either case, you could very well be getting 90% efficiency, Rich. And everyone believes that a dipole has got to be exactly parallel to the ground with the transmission line coming off at right angles. As you slowly tilt a dipole in polarization, until you get it nearly 90 degrees away from the desired, you'd be amazed how slow that signal falls off. It's a cosine theta function trigonometrically, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Well, boy, these rocket pictures are something. The reason why I said right now, the dipole is actually horizontal to the ground because I have the PVC into a flagpole holder, if you could picture that. And because of the length and the small diameter of the PVC, it's bending, which it won't tomorrow. But tonight, it's bending to the point at like 15 feet of coax, PVC. It's bending to the point where it's at, the elements are actually parallel instead of vertical. And the other question, Dick, is if I spray painted the I call them the elements, the rods, which spray paint, which I don't think would affect anything, but if I spray paint the rods, will I lose anything doing that?
Not a chance. If you wanted to put a lossy kind of paint on those rods to stop the RF from coming off of them, you'd be amazed how difficult that would be. You'd have to use material that's many inches thick, that's highly absorptive at the frequency you're using. Now, I don't think you can find paint that's bad enough to give you any measurable effect, Rich. Go ahead.
No, I'm not talking, spraying, using spray paint to direct the signal or affect it in any way. I'm just doing it to hide the antenna a little better. So that's all I was wondering. I was also wondering, the top element is hardly touching it's clamped to the very top of the PC, but the element pointing down is actually, on the PVC for the whole length. Does that affect anything? I mean, I wouldn't think so, but just ask.
I think the PVC is a minor effect. The coax being neater, the lower element, is a major effect. It's adding extra capacitance. And if you're using something like a hose clamp to hold the element, the upper element to the PVC, the presence of the hose clamp is a small capacitive top hat. If you sweep the antenna, you may find out that it's tuned to a bit lower in frequency than you planned for. And unless you're getting a more than a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, I wouldn't worry. At your favorite frequency. Over to you, Rich.
Well, that brings something else up. I'm sure you know about this. I ordered an SWR meter, but an 11-meter SWR meter, because they're much more inexpensive, and I read where you can get a decent idea of your SWR on 2 meters by first attaching everything the way it should, the transmitter into the input, and then the other line out to the antenna, and then turning up the control on the SWR meter as far as it goes, and then not keying it, and then reversing after you let the mic go, after you let the transmitter go, reversing the input, and they say that you could, when you re-key it, you can get a pretty good idea on 2 meters. Would you agree, Dick?
Not quite. Big difference on brand name and the particular design. I had an 11-meter Viswar meter that when I used it on 2 meters, way beyond its rated frequency, the diode that was in there wasn't rated for that higher frequency. Therefore, the diode would heat up, and it would give an indication, then jump down to zero, because the diode acted like a short circuit when it got hot. The short circuit, a diode no longer absorbed RF energy, and it cooled off, and it would cycle back up again, if you know what I mean. The readings had a good 20% of error when it was working, but it only worked intermittently because of the overheating of that particular 11-meter Viswar meter. So it's very different as a function of the particular design and what's the quality of the diode they put in there. So you could run some experiment into dummy loads, and like you can put two 50-ohm resistors in parallel with a T-connector. You know you should be getting a 2-to-1 Viswar, and find out, does it read 2-to-1? So there's various ways you can check its calibration at 2 meters. I recommend you do that, Rich. Go ahead.
This 11-meter SWR meter, you just connected it one way, right? With and the way it should be connected. You didn't reverse the connections after keying the transmitter and then letting it go, then unscrewing the both sides and reversing them. Did you do that?
No, I didn't. But even if I did do it, the result you get would be necessary but not sufficient. So it gives you a little bit of an indication of directivity. You'd be better off calibrating it with known dummy loads, in my opinion. Over to you.
Okay, I can't switch to it now because I'm fixated on this rocket coming back, but hopefully after it lands, I can just read a short, little paragraph about why people say this works, even though, as you say, it's, maybe 30% off in accuracy.
Rocket has landed, by the way, WS2N.
When you reverse it, you're finding out, is the forward diode and the reverse diode at 2 meters having the same response? That's necessary but not sufficient. A bad result is a bad result. A good result might not be really the accuracy you're looking for. The dummy load tests are quite a bit better. Paul, on the screen, I'm seeing a rocket blasting, so am I seeing a delayed broadcast? WS2N, K2RAW?
The first stage has already landed. They showed it probably, I guess, 45 seconds ago. Now, this is what you're just looking at there. That's space. That's the second stage, bringing the satellite to orbit. So that's the second stage. It's a Merlin D engine, and then now that just shut off. So that's what you're looking at now. But the first stage has landed successfully back at Vandenberg Air Force Base, landing zone 4, they call it.
So that's the first time they've done a re-landing back on the West Coast, I think you're saying, Paul. So SpaceX must be pretty happy. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, that's real. When they do it in Florida, it's about 3 miles away from the pad. This is only about 1,400 feet away from the pad when they, you know, from where they take off. So, you know, in the future, they'll have maybe some daytime flights, but this one was, you know, if you look close, I was looking close, you could see the landing legs open up and the thing landed. But replays will be done on the same website. You know, a couple hours from now, they'll play replays of the same thing. They'll keep that up for probably a week or two.
Paul, right now I'm seeing some kind of a gas squirting out the side of the rocket. What's going on there?
Yeah, again, you're looking at the second stage. That's just off-gassing, I think, because that rocket is shut down. That's the second stage, and off-gassing. See that pulsation? I guess, any kind of off-gassing that might be left in the system.
So the second stage has completed its mission. Are they now on the third stage, or is it in some kind of a coast mode right now? I wasn't watching continuously.
Yeah, but Falcon 9 is a two-stage rocket. Right now you got the separation of the payload. So it's a two-stage rocket. The second stage successfully put that satellite into orbit. Now it's separated. It just separated. I think it's around 350 miles up or so. And that's the end of SpaceX responsibility. Now that satellite will be followed by Argentina. It's actually launched for Argentina. It's a SAR mission, S-A-R, synthetic aperture radar mission. Oh, you see it sitting at the pad there, Dick, on the right-hand side.
Roger, Dodger.
And that's the second time that boost ever went up. That went up one other time back in July.
And that has landed back on the pad and got refurbished and used again, is what I think you're saying.
Yeah, it launched from California back in July and put 10 Iridium satellites into space. But this is the first time they brought it back to land in California, so that means back in July that thing landed on the autonomous ship out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you know, 300-400 miles out.
What's involved with refurbishing one of these booster rockets, W2BZ?
What happened was this is the last iteration of these rockets. They call it Block 5. Previous before that, it was Block 4, and there was a lot of maintenance and things that had to be done to get it to fly again. There's a lot less on this. Block 4, they would only fly it twice, and this thing, they're going to fly 10 times and then refurbish it, and then another 10 times and then refurbish it, up to 100 times on the Block 5. They've really cut down on the maintenance. So essentially, they're going to bring it back, make sure nothing's broken, and reuse it. Even the legs are reusable. The previous ones, the legs were not reusable. They'll fold them back up again, and they'll be good to go. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, that was kind of fun, Roy. I mean, Paul, thank you. Roy, I wonder if you got a chance to view that launch. EC2GS, K2RAW.
Yes, I was watching the end of it. I didn't get around to running it through my web browser until we had I had a pause. So I saw the last 5-10 minutes.
Okay, I think you can continue in what you were running before the launch. Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, I mean, basically we were talking about the hobby. I don't know if Rich has anything further to say about the subject. If he does, we can continue with it.
No, I'm having my 58 years of being licensed. It was on and off in terms of my involvement. It was never constant. And now I'm back around 8 months or so. And when I was W-2 BZZ in Queens in my younger days, I talked to a lot of guys. Because of divorce, my log books are gone. I kept immaculate log books. I had a great time on 2 and 6 meter AM with a Polycom 62B. Worked guys all around Queens and whenever. Had a good group of guys. And I couldn't imagine my life without it. That's my last comment. Like you say, whether it's voice over IP or throwing a signal into the air, it doesn't matter as long as you're having fun, as Dick has been describing, with local guys and guys you really like and getting to know. That's what's happening now, and I really enjoy it out here in Riverhead. W2BZ.
Very good. I tend to think that that's the whole point of the exercise, ultimately, is to have fun and enjoy yourself. If any aspect of this hobby, unfortunately, gives you an ulcer, then it's the universe's way of of telling you to go find another hobby.
I have to say the TechNet has been a large part of the enjoyment, even though I'm one of those guys who doesn't understand a lot of it. I'm not an engineer. The math stopped me. But I would, you know, that's what I wanted to be. The higher math, I just couldn't get. But I love listening to it. I've learned an amazing amount of stuff on the TechNet, and I just wish beyond ham radio there should be some kind of broadcasting award for the TechNet. W2BZ.
The TechNet was given a nice big award by the board of directors of the ARRL a few years ago. So it did receive a very nice award. It received the award twice, which is a story in itself. You know what they say about the New York Times? It's nice to know you don't have to read it all, but it's nice to know it's all there. In the case of the TechNet, you don't have to understand every bit of it. If you keep listening, some portions of it that you don't understand at first will start becoming a little bit more understandable at a later time. Whenever a human being, let me drop. From my point of view, whenever a human being is exposed to brand new material that you're trying to learn, in the beginning, the learning process is not direct, not simple, it's not easy, it's uncomfortable. New material that you're not familiar with is going to be uncomfortable. You have to expect that ahead of time. So people are surprised if they feel uncomfortable with not understanding it all immediately. If you're really feeling comfortable with new material, well, then you had a whole lot of previous experience that you either do or don't remember. So a new material is going to be uncomfortable. And listen long enough, you're eventually going to understand it. In theory, a person could suddenly be thrown into China, and he lives in nowhere else. He'll eventually learn Chinese, if you know what I mean. So you dwell in the TechNet long enough, and some more of the material is going to make some sense as you start hearing it from various methods of approach. There are people who say, gee, I don't like listening to the TechNet. Some of the material is repeated. I've heard that before. Well, not necessarily. Each time that repeated material is displayed, it's usually displayed a slightly different manner. Over to you, Rich, for any other comments. K2R, have you?
Absolutely, and as I said before, your explanation of polarization of antennas and how they might end up in some guy's house in Germany you know, vertically rather than horizontally, you know, stuff like that has blown my mind because, like I say, I was licensed at 12 and I turned 70 on Tuesday. But I'm talking about there should be an award for the Technic in the Museum of Broadcasting, not just ham radio. I really feel that, you know. Why not? You know, it's the information disseminated on the TechNet is as important as any information disseminated on a sitcom. W2BZ.
Yeah, September of 2018 is the 36th year of the TechNet, 36 years. The total number of hours the TechNet has been on the air is greater than the total number of hours Johnny Carson was on the air in his 30 years. And the last 11 years are recorded, and you can go to the website, amateurradio.tangovictor, and listen to it. So, and I think it might be a record holder in the total number of hours on the air under essentially one leadership. So it virtually holds a record along those lines. When it first got started, I was positive it was going to last for a couple of months. We'd answer people's questions and dry up and go away. There's always new people joining. There's always new kinds of ham radio coming into existence. So it's an evolving thing. And I never would have guessed that. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick. Well, I've listened and learned for the 7 years that I have had my license, and it was always a pleasure to listen, and it's an equal pleasure to be part of the participants in it. And I got to talk to Dr. Allen to have this thing put up for another award one of these days. So, and I've listened to the archives, so I've been able to listen to Mel K2KEY as well.
Another way to look at it is the TechNet is a radio show that's been broadcasted for 36 years. So a radio show that's been broadcasted, to me, deserves recognition in all of radio show broadcasting.
Problem with that, unfortunately, is that the FCC doesn't like amateurs broadcasting. They want us communicating, but not necessarily broadcasting.
We're talking back and forth to each other. That's not broadcasting.
Entirely. That's why I don't know if we should get a broadcasting award or a communications award. Okay, I think we talked out this little aspect. It's up to you, Dick, if you want me to give a little mini science talk or you want to just go over to Paul, and then if there's free time left, I'll do some articles.
Yeah, because of that successful blast-off, the successful launch, I imagine Paul's got quite a bit more information to give us about that. Let's go over to Paul now and tell us your impression of this launch, Paul. Looks like just about everything worked the way it's supposed to. And what's next? And what other launches are we about to get in line for? WS2N with the space report. And if you run out of material, we'll come back to science. So it's your choice, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yeah, there's so much going on between these types of flights and then manned flights. There's like no end to it. This one went off very successful. They've been looking to do it for a long time. They finally got an approval by for the government to do it. They wanted to do it probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. So they've really proven themselves. This is a 12-foot diameter, 15-story building that takes off and then comes back, and that's quite an accomplishment. Landing legs, we talked about them there. And then, you know, there's four landing legs, 60 feet. You've got these titanium fins that you see at the very top. You know, what you're looking at is the top, from the top of the rocket down. That's why you see these fins sticking out. They open up, and as it starts to catch air, they actuate. They move around, and with the GPS systems and all the accelerometers they have, it's able to guide itself either to a ship or, in this case, back to land. So their goal was to reduce the cost of flights, and now they've really gotten to that point. So, you know, you've got, this is the last version of the Falcon 9 rocket. They started, about 12 years ago, developing, launching single-engine rockets, and then that led to the Falcon 9. They were gonna do a Falcon 5, but it led to the Falcon 9. He calls them all Merlin engines, 9 Merlin engines, and they've gone up, you know, letters, Merlin A, B, C, you know, they're up to Merlin D engines, so each one's been upgraded, more thrust in each one. They're all, you're able to move the engines around to guide itself back to the landing zone. It's got, at the top of that booster, it has, they call them cold jet firing rockets, which really is pressurized nitrogen. So when it's in space and they're trying to realign it, well, it does it all automatically. When it's trying to realign itself, it uses these nitrogen rockets to do that. And in this case, there's three different burns. They separated from the second stage. Second stage went on. That's only one Merlin D engine. That's pushing it on, pushing the satellite into orbit. But that booster does like a 180 with the help of these nitrogen jets. And three of the 9 rockets come on and pushes itself back to. So in this case, Vandenberg Air Force Base. Now, then they shut off. And then the nitrogen jets come on again, and it realigns itself looking down with, you know, legs first. And then the 3 engines come on again. They call that the re-entry burn. The re-entry burn is, you know, you get to the thicker air. You start to pick up thicker air. Up everything underneath, and that would cause, you know, quite a bit of damage, so they need to slow it down. So these 3 engines come on one more time, relatively short period of time, so it, you know, it really picks up a lot of atmosphere. The fins are really working, controlling its re-entry back to the site, and then at the last, it's got maybe 15, 20, 30 seconds or so, just the center engine comes on. You know, you have 9 engines. The center one will come on, and that's the landing burn. Let me drop it. And that's being actuated, so you know, it's moving around bringing it right to this concrete pad that they built with an X on it. They put their logo on it with SpaceX. So they try to hit the middle, and they do pretty good. This is the 17th flight this year for SpaceX. They have quite a few more to go. So that's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions on this particular rocket? By the way, it's going to launch again sometime in the future.
I noticed that this is called an instantaneous launch at 7:21 p.m. Pacific time, which is what, 11:21 our time, 10:21 our time. Instantaneous launch implies that there's some other spacecraft in orbit that it is coupling to in some way. I presume that's what it means. In other words, you've got to launch at exactly that time. The window, is it called an instantaneous launch because the window is 0 seconds long, so to speak, Paul, on this launch versus the October 11th launch, WS2N, K2IW?
Well, yeah, it's they've got 1 second to go, and that's it. You know, some of the launches don't have that. This one does. It's a radar mission, a SAR mission. So, it's going to be working in conjunction with another another one that's up there. Might be a third one that they would like to put up, but it's a synthetic aperture radar built by Argentina and now operated from Argentina. After you saw that satellite leave, that's the end of SpaceX responsibility, and now everything is now controlled from mission control in Argentina. So, this particular satellite, the other one that's up there, they're interested in the soil, and you know, soil is going to be good for growing. All kinds of pectins in the soil all through, actually throughout the world. Anything that wants to connect with this thing, and it's going to give them, you know, information about that. Plus, it's a radar mission as well. And that's it. You've got, I think it was probably, let's see, 17, probably about 9 more missions, or 8 or 9 more missions for SpaceX before the end of the year.
Now, the word synthetic aperture radar, there's a couple of different ways you can produce a really big antenna. You can have a very long vehicle that the antenna is mounted on, and that can give you a very wide antenna, which can give you a very narrow beam with high resolution. Or, if the vehicle is moving, you can take carefully calibrated snapshots at a couple of different locations in the orbit of the vehicle, and when you put it all back together, it's as if the antenna really was that big between the first shot and the last shot. Now, in this particular case, where you're launching a second vehicle, which I'm guessing is part of the synthetic aperture radar, it sounds to me like they want a very specific distance between the already in existence vehicle that's up there versus the one they just launched. They want a very specific distance between the two to carry on that project, and that the two vehicles running simultaneously act like a very large synthetic aperture antenna with very few empty spaces in between if you take enough snapshots. Is that approximately what's happening in this case, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Most likely. I haven't read much about the specific mission, but you know, the other star missions that NASA has launched, and you know, have that type of setup anytime they launch two or more satellites that have something to do with one another, that's what goes on. The GRACE mission that they launched not too long ago didn't really matter. They wanted to get the two satellites up at the exact same time. It was no problem because they were both on the same rocket. But if they're bigger satellites and they're going up on two separate rockets, then that's another story. I guess that's a good reason to make it a 1 second window. So that's it. There's other things going on with the space program. We just had 3 astronauts come back from the International Space Station last week, and at least 3 more on board. There were 6, and that is 3. They successfully came back and landed in Kazakhstan, and now I believe another week or so from now, I think it's October 11th, they'll be launching from Kazakhstan again, sending up astronaut Nick Haig, another ham by the way, KG5TMV, as well as a Russian counterpart. Only 2 people going up this time, not 3. So in a week or so, we're just going to have a 5-person crew instead of the regular 6-person crew. So that's interesting. This has gone on before, but now they're back to this 5-person crew again. Back to you, Dave.
During that landing, I believe the retro rockets that fire just before the aircraft, before the spacecraft hits the ground, kicked up a whole lot of dust. And there were some news reports at first that misinterpreted that dust as a crash landing. I wonder if you saw that on the news, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, and what happened is it was a beautiful day, and it landed right on the money, and the cameras are right there, and this happens on all their launches, you know, all their landings. They come down with one big parachute, and then they get, you know, close to the earth, that heat shield blows off pretty high up, and then it exposes these rockets that ignite just for a second, just as they hit the ground, to soften the blow. But, you know, you're landing in Kazakhstan, is nothing but dust. They call it the steppes of Kazakhstan, so it's almost like a desert, a cold desert. Land in the snow, and, you know, it's just a barren place, and all that smoke comes flying up and creates a problem. There have been some rough landings where people have been jarred up pretty good, but nothing too serious. But any astronaut that comes out of there tells you it's like a controlled crash. You know, it's pretty jarring when you hit.
Are you saying even with those retro rockets would soften the landing, it's still kind of jarring to land?
Oh yeah, most of the times. From what I've read over the years, and it's been going on for decades now, you come down on that thing, it's you know, pretty rough landing. On top of that, sometimes they have a pretty strong wind. They didn't have that in this case, and that the parachutes will pull that spacecraft over on its side, so you tend to tumble once in a while. Not over and over, but, you know, and that's why many of the flights, they land there, they actually land on the side. The goal is to try to land straight up, and then they put this aluminum gadget over the top of it, and they climb, you know, people climb up and help the astronauts and cosmonauts straight up through the center of the Soyuz spacecraft. Other times, if they land on the side, they'll pull them out, actually, you know, laying down on the side. I read that report. And then if you read the NASA report, you know, smooth landing, you know, no problem.
Do those retro rockets sometimes fire early or late and don't quite do the job correctly? Is that what makes some of the landings a little more rougher, Paul?
I think they're all about the same. You know, they're coming down with that big parachute and that slows them down to whatever speed they need to get down to. You know, I think it's 20 miles an hour or something, so they just have to get that last little bit out. And then inside, all the seats, they compress. So, you know, essentially, it's like landing in, with sitting in a seat with big shock absorbers behind you. So that softens the blow, too. But it's not all that bad. Now, when Boeing starts doing it, we have Boeing building the Starliner, and they'll be going up this fall, this coming fall, you know, not, you know, 2019. They'll be sending a couple of people up. Starliner, when they come down, they're coming back on land, like Russia is, and same type of deal. The only difference is when they get close to the Earth, they're going to have these big airbags pop out on the bottom, surround the whole craft, and that's what's going to soften their blow. So I think we have a little bit better system.
If you deploy airbags and land on that, what stops the spacecraft from bouncing back up again?
Call it controlled deflation. So, you know, as you hit, these things instantly deflate, you know. They go through this naturally, probably testing over and over to make sure it works. From what I understand, it works pretty good. Yeah, they run many testing. Take the Starliner, the spacecraft, or some, you know, simulations of it, and push it out of the back of a cargo, military cargo vehicle, you know, from 6 miles up, and the thing will come down, and they'll duplicate the speed of the landing. So I think right now they know it's going to work.
Is it a ground-looking radar that tells them when to fire those rockets? Paul, go ahead.
I would imagine Starliner has it. I haven't read that yet. I know Russia has it. You know, so those rockets, you know, it's not like the astronaut is pushing a button, the time to push the rockets, you know. I mean, it's going off automatically. So that's the deal with that. So after SpaceX gets, you know, better, you know, really good with Falcon 9, they're going to start in with their BFR, the big Falcon rocket, and that'll be a big deal. I mean, the difference between Falcon 9 and this thing is going to be tremendous. You know, the Falcon 9 overall height is 229 feet, they say. This thing's going to be almost 400 feet. The diameter of Falcon 9 is 12 foot. This thing's diameter is 30 feet. So it's going to be a big difference. You know, you talk about the future. You asked about that. You know, what's in the future? A couple of years from now, they'll be testing the BFR. Maybe, you know, originally they'll be probably launching in Texas, from what I see. Boca Chica. He's built the SpaceX. Elon Musk has built a launch complex in Boca Chica, Texas, right near Brownsville, right where, you know, where Mexico and Texas meet.
And how many rocket engines are going to be on that 30-foot diameter thing? And the oil are going to be properly regulated? That scares me a little bit, because the Soviet Union, during the Apollo time, tried doing that, and the instability was fierce, as I remember.
Yeah, they had all kinds of piping problems. Yeah, this will be 31 engines, and they were all these engines now are 3D manufactured. SpaceX was like the first company to do that, as far as I know. A lot of the connections and everything is being manufactured like that. Turbo pumps have been approved. The original turbos, they found some cracking in them, and NASA didn't like that, you know, in the early cargo flights. Although it didn't cause any accidents or problems, they said you're going to have to fix that. Since then, they've fixed that. You know, these things spin at like 100,000 RPM or something, and apparently SpaceX has done it to the satisfaction of NASA, and that is what's on one of the things or improvements that's on this Block 9 that we saw take off tonight. There's been a lot of improvements between the Block 4 and the Block 5 Falcon 9 rocket. But the new one is going to have different engines. The BFR is going to have, they call them Raptor engines instead of Merlin engines. So it's like Merlin engines on steroids, but not kerosene for a fuel. They're going to use liquid methane for a fuel and liquid oxygen. And the power out of this thing is going to be almost 14 million pounds of thrust compared to the, I think it's 2.3 million pounds of thrust now you get with the Falcon 9.
Do each of the 30 engines have their own turbo pump, Paul? And you've got to make sure the 30 turbo pumps all sing correctly?
Yes, they do, and all these Raptor engines are also going to be reusable, you know. In the early days for SpaceX, you know, when all these rockets were crashing into the ocean, actually, in the early ones, they were just happy to get them off the ground, but then they started to try to land them on the barges, and they crashed into the barge, and you know, each time they did that, they'd lose nine engines. And now that they haven't lost, I can't remember the last time they lost a rocket. I think they've done 20, 25 or 26 successful landings in a row now. That's pretty amazing. And yeah, each one has their own turbo pump. Each one is an individual engine.
With a couple of engines failing, I am guessing you would abort to orbit. What's the maximum number of engines that can fail where you can't do that? And what's the backup for that situation, Paul?
Right now, Elon Musk says two engine out right now on Falcon 9. He can still get the craft, the satellite to orbit. You know, he might not be able to bring the booster back, you know, all the way back to land like he thought, but at least he knows he can get the payload to orbit. and he's getting paid for all these things, you know. So a lot of these launches, most of the launches he's doing is, you know, we're not paying 10 cents for. He's launching for, like, this one was Argentina. You know, they're paying him that. And by the way, that's why you can't see these launches on NASA TV, you know.